What's going on, everyone, and welcome to the Surprise Jab Podcast. I'm your host, Zach Ruger, surprising you with new topics every single week and jabbing you with your daily dose of UFC information, all the fun stuff, all sorts of good stuff. And guess what? We have another card this weekend, and yes, it could quite possibly be the worst UFC event in the history that they've ever put on, but guess what? Nonetheless, we're going to cover it, and we're going to cross our fingers and hope for the best. Also on today's episode, we're going to be checking in with the NFL, with the NBA, with the NHL, checking in with all of our major sports leagues. Of course, March Madness is going on. That's kind of the bulk of what we're going to be talking about on next week's episodes, because don't get me wrong, it's going to be tough breaking out all the games. I've already watched at least like 8 as we speak. By the time this uploads or potentially you listen, the round of 64 could be done. We don't unfortunately have a perfect bracket. You know, we made a lot, but nonetheless, it's tough to predict a perfect bracket, but that's not for us today. Also, we're going to be looking at WrestleMania 11 through 20 in this new little series. We're on part 2 of this little series where we revisit all the past WrestleManias in the build-up to WrestleMania 40, which goes down April 6th and 7th. I'm also excited for that. I'll actually be dropping my predictions for that, and I know people say, oh, it's scripted, but we still don't know the outcome, all right? It's still a mystery to us, so strap in, get on your sports caps, because we got a lot to go over. And kicking us off, as always, we go with some new UFC news. And unfortunately for me, you know, I actually had the Kentucky and Oakland game on right now. It's tied as we speak, under 3 minutes. But nonetheless, let's check in and see if we've had any new fights announced. And we last checked in Monday, of course, which was March 18th. If I'm not mistaken, and since March 18th, we've had a couple of official fight announcements, one of which is going down in UFC St. Louis, May 11th, as Waldo Cortez Acosta will be taking on Robles Despange. Robles Despange, fresh off his win over Josh Parshin, knocked him out in under a minute. Super hype. Bad boy, Robles Despange, 5-0, all-round one knockouts, all, I think, in under a minute, except for one. This guy is an absolute madman. Excited to see him come back. And Waldo Cortez Acosta, 4-1 in the UFC, 11-1 professionally. Biggest win of his career last time out against Andrei Arlovsky. Also holds wins over Chase Sherman and Lucas Brzezinski. I'm honestly surprised they're giving someone like this to Robles. They must think that Robles can handle someone on Waldo Cortez Acosta's level, as honestly, he could definitely fight for a bottom 15 spot in the men's heavyweight division. He could definitely take on number 15 ranked Rodrigo Nascimento, number 14 ranked Marcos Sergio de Lima. I definitely see that happening, but happy to see them fight. Happy to see Robles getting a quick turnaround, might I add. That's something else that I'm very happy to see, and I obviously expect him to get another round one knockout. Like I said, ride the round one knockouts till they just fade away. I don't know. Ride them till they fade away. Another fight announced for UFC Vegas 91 going down in the Apex on April 27th. You got Tim Dirty Bird Means taking on Uros the Dr. Medic. Uros Medic 9-2 professionally, 3-2 in the UFC, holds wins over Matthew Selmelsberger, Omar Morales, and Aylin Cruz. Fun fighter. And Tim Dirty Bird Means, legend of the UFC. He's had, I believe this will actually be his 29th UFC fight. When he does partake in this fight, I believe it'll be his, if I'm not mistaken, his 51st fight overall. That is just absolutely crazy. Legend in the game. I do kind of lean Uros Medic in that, but hey, anything can happen. It's fighting. It's the fight game. Who knows what goes down in the UFC. Also announced going down on same card, UFC Vegas 91, we actually go to a ranked light heavyweight. This actually is very surprising to me, as number 11 ranked Ryan Spann in the men's light heavyweight division will be defending his ranked spot against Bogdan Guskov. Bogdan Guskov had originally fought last year in September, losing to number 9 ranked Volkan Ozdemir. They then gave him a lesser opponent in Zach Pauga last time out earlier this year, and he was able to knock him out in round one. So he gets finished by a top 10 guy. They give him a bum who they cut, might I add, Zach Pauga, and now they're throwing him back in the rankings. They must see something in Bogdan that we don't. But by the way, Bogdan Guskov, that is Gus. There's so many Bogdans. I'm thinking of NBA names as well. 15-3 professionally with, I believe, 13 knockouts. Dude's legit. Ryan Superman Spann, 7-4 in the UFC, 21-9 professionally, holds knockout wins over Rogério Nogueira, Ion Cutelaba, Dominic Reyes. This guy's a killer. He's fun to watch, and I'm happy to see him fight. Also announced recently today, we head to the men's flyweight division as number 8 ranked Alex Perez will take on number 12 ranked Tagir Ulanbekov on June 15th at an unannounced UFC Apex card. Alex Perez is 24-8 professionally, but is on a 3-fight losing streak. Yikes. We'll see if he can turn his luck around against Tagir Ulanbekov, who's 4-1 in the UFC. He holds wins over Alan Nascimento, Cody Durden, Nate Maniz. Comes from that Dagestani wrestling crew, if you will. So you can probably get a grasp of how he's going to perform when he steps in the octagon. But hey, fun fight nonetheless. Happy to see Tagir getting a top 10 opponent. Very excited for that. A lot of other unofficial news going down. Of course, Roadhouse came out the movie with Jake Gyllenhaal and Conor McGregor. I'll actually have to watch that. My buddies invited me to watch it tonight at their house, but unfortunately, I'm busy tonight watching March Madness and recording this podcast. We will be unable to watch that movie, but I'll get around to it. I want to see how good Conor McGregor's acting is, because I've heard it's not the best, but at the same time, it's Conor McGregor. I'm sure he can fit any role he wants to. Another unofficial bout that I've heard is in the works for a UFC. I think it's UFC 302 or maybe Brazil. Cause I mean, May Brazil, it could still go down, but number 4 ranked Jared Cannonier, number 7 ranked Paulo Costa in the men's middleweight division. I've heard they're trying to get that fight done. I've heard they're trying to get Paulo Costa on that Brazilian card. It would be super exciting to see him fight. So I really do hope they get that fight done. But other than that, not too many other UFC fights announced. There were a couple cuts today. The UFC did elect to get rid of some of their fighters, and you know, I'm not gonna say I'm so surprised by these. I just wasn't really expecting to see these fighters be cut so soon. But Brian Barberina, legend of the UFC, 10 plus fights, been there for quite a while, and you know, he's on a 4-fight losing streak, been submitted in 3 of those, so that's not really too surprising to see him get cut. But I mean, just still tough seeing him go, but he was a fun time on the roster, and I wish him nothing but the best in his future endeavors. Also officially cut from the roster is Joanne Wood, who officially retired, so she's just been removed from the roster. But you know, nothing too special there with Joanne Wood. Not to sound mean, not to sound offensive, like, oh, like she's not that good. But I mean, she's certainly not the best. Not the best of all the others. Also cut from the UFC, Josh Parsons, who we mentioned him earlier, Robelis Despongue, knocked him out in like 40 seconds. This guy hasn't gotten a win in a while, been brutally knocked down in the majority of his fights. Not surprising at all. Also cut, though, this one very surprising. This one very surprising, and I don't necessarily... I'd be actually very curious to see the reasoning behind this, but Felipe Lins has been cut from the UFC, and this guy's actually on a 4-fight win streak and actually just picked up a big win in his last bout against Ion Cutelaba. Very perplexed at why he was cut from the UFC. He kind of hasn't lost in like the last 3 years, so very perplexing. If I can get some explanations here. Josh Parsian, by the way, was on a 2-first-round finish losing streak, so he'd been knocked down the last two rounds. Felipe Lins just removed for no reason. They don't really have a reason at all, so pretty comical, pretty funny, but like I said, nothing really much more to say about any of that. We can kind of drag out our UFC news, but for us to this episode, none of that at all. Moving on from UFC news to some fun stuff in the NBA world. That's right, we have to do our little NBA check-in, as we always do, checking in with the leagues, seeing what's up. And as we go to the NBA, no surprise here, the best team in the Eastern Conference is the Boston Celtics, 55-14. At the moment, they're the only 50-win team in the NBA. I mean, an impressive 32-3 at home on a 7-game win streak, 8-2 in their last 10. Impressive as always. They should be the favorite to win the NBA title as we speak. But like I said, a lot can happen. A lot can happen in the NBA playoffs and certainly in the finals, where the Celtics are yet to win since 2008, I believe it is. It's been a fat minute. Number two team in the Eastern Conference, the Milwaukee Bucks, 44-25 record. They are 27-7 at home, not too bad. 6-4 the last 10. You know, they kind of rotate with the number three team, the Cavaliers, who are 43-26, but they're 4-6 their last 10, so they're not hot as well. But Bucks and Cavs, probably your number two and number three teams in the East. Number four currently is the Knicks, but they do hold the same record as the Magic, who aren't in fifth. Both have 41 wins, 28 losses, and both are on a 4-game win streak, so good for them. Happy to see it. And yeah, good stuff for them. The Pacers in sixth, they got 39 wins. Heat in seventh, 38 wins. Same with the 76ers in eighth. Bulls in ninth and the Hawks in 10th, fighting for those play-in spots. The Nets trying to get a play-in spot. They're 26-43 on a 4-game losing streak. In fact, the bottom five teams in the Eastern Conference are all on losing streaks. Number 12 ranked Raptors, 23-46. Are 1-9 their last 10 on a 8-game losing streak. Just atrocious. Hornets are 17-52. They're on a 3-game losing streak. Pistons, 12-57. They did get into the double-digit win column, but they're still on a 4-game losing streak. And the Wizards, 11-58 with 5 losses, making them officially the worst team in the NBA. The Washington Wizards with no star power. Absolutely no star power on this team. They've only won 4 home games. Imagine being you're a home season ticket buyer, and of the 32 games they've had, they've only ever won 4. That's embarrassing. They've won more road games with 7. But yeah, it's heating up down the stretch. It's honestly kind of filling in their spots. There's right around 14 games left for the NBA this season. Eastern Conference, you know, Nets and Nets can make a little mid-season, end-of-season push. I don't think they're going to get into the playoffs. Moving to the Western Conference, a lot of moves at the top have been going down, but we've kind of separated ourselves with the top three teams in the West. Currently, the Thunder hold that spot with 48 wins, 20 losses. They're on a 3-game win streak. Nuggets are currently in second with 48 wins, 21 losses. And in third, the Timberwolves, 47 wins, 22 losses. Next closest is the Clippers in fourth with 43. So you're kind of seeing the Thunder, Nuggets, and Timberwolves pull away. I am kind of hoping the Timberwolves do fall and get that fourth seed, because I would love to play the number five seed Pelicans, who are 42-26. 3-game win streak for them, but they just do not have as much star power as the Thunder, Nuggets, and Clippers have. So if the Timberwolves can do anything, if we can hopefully get Karl-Anthony Towns back, I don't know if we are, but if we did, that would be very crucial to make it a little run at the cup. Also in the 40-win column, the Kings, Mavericks, and Suns, your 6, 7, and 8 teams, all have 40 wins, 28, 29, 29 losses, and all ride 2-game win streaks. Pretty similar right there. Luka Doncic doing the best for his team. Kyrie Irving hitting insane buzzer beaters. Kings, Domantas Sabonis, De'Aaron Fox, Malik Monk, all stars. And the Suns, you got Bradley Beal, you got Devin Booker, Kevin Durant, star stud team. Lakers trying to avoid the play-in game. I don't think they're going to. 37-32. They are in the number 9 spot. And the Warriors just trying to get a play-in spot with an absolutely terrible team. Curry and Klay probably reaching the latter years of their time in the NBA. They're 36-32, 5-5 over the last 10. Trying to make a little end-of-season push, though, is the Houston Rockets, 33-35 on the year, 8-2 the last 10. They ride a 6-game win streak, longest win streak in the Western Conference. Your bottom four teams, though, Jazz, Grizzlies, Trailblazers, and Spurs, are all on 3-game losing streaks. Actually, Grizzlies and Trailblazers on 4-game losing streaks. Very bad. Very, very bad. Spurs are 15-54. I believe they're the third worst team in the NBA. 4-6 their last 10. Just atrocious. Trailblazers only have 19 wins. I mean, it's pretty embarrassing. As we reach the end, you know, you're kind of seeing it's Thunder, Nuggets, Timberwolves in the West, and just the Celtics in the East. So I don't know who's going to represent each conference. You know, as much as the Celtics are the best team in the league, I don't necessarily see them as a historic, legendary team. So I will kind of say, you know, it's up for grabs up for grabs as we head down the stretch. When we look at some of our averages for the season, Luka Doncic points per game is up 4 points now on Shea as he averages 34 points per game. Jalen Brunson of the New York Knicks, 27.6 points per game, number 5 in the league. Very, very impressive. Rebounds per game, Domantas Sabonis of the Kings, 13.7, leading his team all the way. And Rudy Gobert of the Timberwolves, 12.9. Don't forget about him. Not many other changes. As you look around, Tyrese Haliburton of the Pacers actually leads the league in assists with 11.2 assists per game. Field goal percentage, your centers still have the best. Daniel Gafford actually has 5% better than the guy in second. If you get Zubac, Daniel Gafford, center for the Mavericks, shoots 70.8% from the field. But mind you, those are all little layups, little chip-ins, little free throw type shots. Nothing too special. Most three-pointers made on the year, I mean, Stephen Curry has 301. The next closest This is Luka Doncic with 234. There's levels to this. There is levels to this, and Stephen Curry is on that level. Three-point shooting percentage, though, actually goes to former Duke player Grayson Allen, 48.3% from three. He leads Luke Kennard of the Grizzlies, who has 45 in second place. Blocks per game, Victor Wembanyama continues to up his total. Every time we check in, averages 3.5 blocks per game. Next closest is Walker Kessler of the Jazz with 2.5. Last stat, steals per game, Shai Gilgeous-Alexander, the only person averaging 2 steals per game at 2.1. De'Aaron Fox, though, close in second with 1.9. A lot of stuff to go down as we kind of head down the stretch of the NBA. Not much new news going on. I mean, J.B. Bickerstaff, coach for the Cavaliers, was recently speaking out about how gamblers are threatening the livelihoods of his players by cheering stuff during games. I mean, if anything, betting makes games more fun. I won't lie. So I don't really know why he's getting all mad. Kevin Looney has actually fallen out of the Warriors rotation, not even on the 10-man squad. Wow. Very embarrassing. And the G League Ignite to shut down. The G League Ignite program will not continue past the season. I have no idea what that means, but yeah, unfortunate to see that's not going down. By the way, for Victor Wembanyama, you know, obviously he's going to win Rookie of the Year for the NBA, but he also could win Defensive Player of the Year, which would be pretty incredible. I wish him nothing but the best, but that's all we got for the NBA as we kind of wind down the season. Next time we check in, they'll probably be under 10 games. Probably be under 10 games as we keep going down the stretch, you know, but yeah, that's all the NBA we have for today. Bounce some balls on the March Madness court. All right, that's what I'm watching, March Madness. No more NBA, but I tell you what, a bunch of my buddies are watching, and that's the NHL. Oh, also, speaking of hockey, right before we're about getting to NHL, I am so excited because we're actually going to make some Frozen Four brackets. That's right, we're going to make some Frozen Four brackets to try and predict that because we don't have any perfect March Madness brackets, but that's 64 teams. There's only 16 hockey teams that make it. So when that bracket comes out in the next week or two, we'll make sure to get on that. Checking in with the NHL, so fun, such a good time. And as we go to, what conference should we go to first? Let's go to the Eastern Conference. It's kind of my theme. I always check out the Eastern Conference first, the AFC, because, you know, I'm a NFC boy. I'm a Western Conference guy. So checking in with the Eastern Conference, your number one team, the Boston Bruins, 97 points. Let that sink in. 1 second, let it sink in. 97 points. The next closest team in the Eastern Conference is the Panthers with 94. And why is that significant? Well, it's because last time we checked in, the Panthers were the freaking best team in the freaking Eastern Conference. And the Bruins have since gone on a 3-game win streak. And the Panthers have gone on a 2-game losing streak. Panthers are actually tied for most wins in the Eastern Conference with 45. Rangers, who are in third with 94 points as well, also have 45 wins. But it's the fact that the Bruins, of their 29 losses, 15 have been in overtime. That'll get you 15 extra points. Happy to see him get that done. Best point differential in the Eastern Conference does still go to the Panthers with plus 59 goals scored compared to given up. Hurricanes are currently in fourth with 92 points, so your top four teams, the only ones with 90. Maple Leafs in fifth with 87 points. Lightning in sixth, got 80 points. A little 4-game win streak for them, not too bad. Hurricanes in fourth, they also are on a 4-game win streak. Checking out the bottom of the pack, Columbus Blue Jackets, worst team in the Eastern Conference with only 58 points. points. Senators in 15th with 60. They're still struggling. Two. Any other big win streaks or losing streaks? Not too many. Montreal Canadiens in 14th. They have 62 points, 25, 31, and 12 on the year. Have a minus 51 point differential. They've been giving up one too many goals. Oddly enough, despite the Senators being the second-to-worst team in the East, they are 3-0 in the shootout. You know, impressive for them there. Which team has gone to the shootout the most? Maple Leafs have gone 7 times. They've gone 5-2. Capitals in 9th. They have 75 points, 33-26-9 record. Have been to the shootout 7 times. They're 3-4. Not too bad, but it's the Montreal Canadiens, actually, who've gone 10 times and are 4-6. Still gotten actually 6 points out of those losses, though, so not too bad. But yeah, Bruins, best team in the league with 97 points. Very impressive, very impressive. Panthers and Rangers tied for second in the league. But yeah, Bruins have also played the most games with 70. I guess Sabres also have 70. But Eastern Conference coming down to the wire. When we check out the wild card, obviously Bruins, Panthers, Maple Leafs, they've got their spots locked up. Rangers, Hurricanes, Flyers, they're just about racked up. I mean, let me actually double check this 69. We're looking at 69 as well. It's looking like they only have about 12 games to 13 games left on the year. Your wild card teams are currently the Tampa Bay Lightning and Detroit Red Wings. Capitals 1 point behind the Red Wings, looking to pass them, but we'll see if they can do it. New York Islanders, they're 3 points back, so not unrealistic. So it's pretty much Islanders, Capitals, Red Wings, and Lightning. We'll see who will make the wild card for the Eastern Conference. But as we check in with the West, the Vancouver Canucks, best team in the West with 94 points, 43-18-8 record. They also have a plus 55 point differential. Very, very nice. Winnipeg Jets in second with 93 points, and the Colorado Avalanche in third also with 93 points. Both of those teams have 44 wins and are in the plus 50s. 4 point differential. Avalanche actually on a 7-game win streak, 9-1 their last 10. Are you freaking kidding me? That is very impressive. That's very impressive. Edmonton Oilers in fifth. They have 86 points. 86 points. I don't know if that's going to cut it to winning the Stanley Cup, but, you know, impressive nonetheless. Kings in seventh. They're also in the 80 club, along with the Predators in sixth. They are both in the 80s. Minnesota Wild in ninth in the conference. So I guess we're almost at the 50% mark. 76 points for 34-28-8 on the year. We do have a minus 9 point differential, so not too sexy there. Worst team in the league, though, does belong to the San Jose Sharks. Only 16 wins. They've had 52 losses, 5-game losing streak, minus 126 point differential. That's insane. So let's say you take the two best point differentials in the league. Was it like plus 57, plus 53? Yeah, you're still not equaling the total for the San Jose Sharks' negative differential. They've scored 150 goals, given up 276. My goodness. Blackhawks are not much better. 19 wins. They're still trying to get into the 20-win column. They only have 43 points. Yeah. Chicago Blackhawks are honestly giving Carolina Panther energy with getting the number one pick and then not really being able to do much with the rest of the team. Ducks, not in the 50 club win club either. They're at 49. They're 14th in the conference. 23 wins on the year, 46 losses. 7-game losing streak for them, too. Ugh, very gross. But, best win streak goes to the Avalanche. Predators on a 3-game win streak as well. A lot of stuff happening, come down to the wire. St. Louis Blues, neck and neck under the Minnesota Wild as they hunt a wild card spot, I believe. Let's check out the wild card for the Western Conference as the playoffs loom. I believe they actually start April 20th. Minnesota Wild, 3 points behind the Vegas Golden Knights for a wild card spot. You gotta be kidding me. Come on, Wild, you can do it. Two less wins than the Golden Knights, but I mean, hell, anything can happen. Blues also in the hunt, but the Flames, they're 8 points behind the Golden Knights. I don't know if they're going to catch them. We'll see. Predators, I'm pretty sure, have just about wrapped up a wild card spot. Predators actually could probably, if the Predators are in the Pacific Division, I would have said they could have gotten a play-in spot, but I mean, just a lock for a spot, but I don't think so. Canucks, best team in this conference. But as for the whole league obviously belongs to the Bruins. At the moment, very impressive stuff. Very happy for them. Checking in with our stat totals. I was talking to one of my buddies at the library the other day, and he said it's kind of comical listening to me read the statistics since I don't really know much. But checking in with the Skaters, Nikita Kucherov, right wing for the Tampa Bay Lightning, 118 points, has the most points in the league. Nathan MacKinnon of the Avalanche, second with 117. Next closest is Connor McDavid. That's right, I know Connor McDavid with 108 points. When it comes to goals, Austin Matthews best in the league from the Toronto Maple Leafs, 57 points. Next closest is Sam Reinhart with 48. He's from the Panthers. Any Minnesota Wild players on this list? I'm not seeing any, sadly. Assists also goes to Connor McDavid. Goes to Connor McDavid with 82. Second is Nikita Kucherov. And third is Nathan MacKinnon. So a lot of top guys getting it done in the assist column. Checking out our goalies, the best goalies. The best GAA goes to Connor Hellebuyck. Goalie for the Winnipeg Jets, 2.30 GAA. After that, the next best in second is Sergei Bobrovsky of the Florida Panthers. Their goalie has a 2.35 GAA, and I think that's his save percentage, if I'm not mistaken. I honestly completely forgot. I remember my buddy Jaden told me, and it completely escaped my mind. But going down this list, I just want to read off these names. Pyotr Kochekov for the Hurricanes. He's the third best GAA, fourth best. From the Buffalo Sabres, their goalie with a 2.39 GAA, Ukko-Pekka Luukkonen. Absolutely amazing name. Love that. Save percentage. Here's what we like to see. Connor Hellebuyck, a 0.923. Very nice. Then we actually have a 1-2-3-4-way tie for second between Cam Talbot of the Kings, Jeremy Swayman of the Bruins, Thatcher Demko, love that name, of the Vancouver Canucks, and Joey Decord of the Kraken. Seattle Kraken. All of them have a .917 save percentage. And shutouts, there have only been two men with six shutouts, and that's Connor Ingram, goalie for the Arizona. Arizona Coyotes. I don't know what I was reading. And Tristan Jarry of the Penguins. Very nice getting in your saves. I don't freaking know. I'm surprised it's not more. Imagine that. I wonder what the record is, actually. What is the record? We're doing some live Googling here. What is the record for most shutouts in a NHL season? Thank you very much. Could you please tell me? They're not really telling me. They're not saying all time. I think it's George Hainsworth, who had 2,800. Might be. I don't know. It's not very helpful. I'm actually on Bing though. That's what happens with Microsoft. It takes you right to Bing, which is not very helpful. But I don't know. We could do another day where we Google all the fun statistics there. But here's what I like to look at: the rookies. Connor Bedard has a insane 16-point lead for points on the next closest rookie. He has 54 on the year. Brock Faber, though, of the Wild in second with 38. Checking in on goals, though, Connor Bedard, 21. Marco Rossi, you know, another rookie from the Minnesota Wild in second with 18. And for assist, Connor Bedard also with 33, but Brock Faber tight on his tail with 32. Very fun stuff there for the boys. Actually, defensemen, we could bring that up. Quinn Hughes has most points. He's from the Vancouver Canucks. Roman Josi has the most goals with 18 for defensemen. He's from the Nashville Predators. And Quinn Hughes, again, 66 assists. Dude's a passing machine. Any defensive men from the Minnesota Vikings? No. Wow, Minnesota Vikings just don't do much. Any fun names on here? The number 9 defenseman for points with 52 from the Buffalo Sabres, Rasmus Dahlin. Rasmus Dahlin. What a fun name. I always love checking in with the NHL. I don't know much, but I think that makes it more fun for the viewers when I'm just kind of going around listing off random stuff here, there. But good stuff, good times. We move on from the NHL to, of course, a league which I like to think I know a thing or two about because, you know, I watched the entire season, the NFL. We're losing out on some news, you know, as the season continues to get closer. Actually, free agency starts to die down, but we have had some stuff be announced in the last few days. First off, Jerry Jeudy, who of course signed with the, or was he traded to the Browns? I can't know, but former Denver Broncos wide receiver Jerry Jeudy is officially agreed to a 3-year extension with the Browns worth up to $58 million with $41 million guaranteed. By the way, Jerry Jeudy, not the best wide receiver. I think he fulfills his role as a wide receiver too decently well, maybe a bit below average. But I mean, this dude is already making $41 million like guaranteed, and he hasn't even played a snap. The Browns seem to be very irresponsible with their money. Remember, they made Deshaun Watson the most paid quarterback of all time, and he didn't even up playing a majority of their games. Joe Flacco was a better QB than him, but wild stuff there. The other major big news is Jets are signing wide receiver Mike Williams to a 1-year deal for $15 million. Everyone's hopping on that Aaron Rodgers train, but be careful, Mike. You might end up having Zach Wilson throw it to you, but Mike Williams, an excellent pickup. I can't believe the Chargers dropped him. Like, it's actually a bit shocking because that dude is actually, you know what? Now that I think about it, the Chargers got rid of their two best wide receivers, and Justin Herbert's just kind of sitting there like, guys, could you help me out? Could you give me someone? But no, they can't. Happy for you, Mikey, though. Happy for you. As the NFL draft gets closer and closer, I love seeing these mock drafts. Here's one from Daniel Jeremy, who I believe is on Move the Sticks. He's an NFL Network lead draft analyst, actually is a Chargers radio analyst and former Appalachian State QB. He's verified. He's legit. But listen to this. Drafting number 3, the Patriots, Jaden McDaniels, former LSU quarterback, number 3 pick. He has him going to the Patriots, and he has the Minnesota Vikings trading up with Arizona to take J.J. McCarthy at 4. Personally, I love it. I saw some people hating on J.J. McCarthy because they're comparing him to Brock Purdy, and I'm like, okay, Brock Purdy has led teams in both of his seasons with the 49ers, led them to deep in the postseason, including a Super Bowl runner-up, and they almost won the Super Bowl. I hate when people just criticize. Number 5 pick, they have the Jets trading up with the Chargers to get Marvin Harrison Jr. That does not make sense. They wouldn't sign Mike Williams if they're going to draft Marvin Harrison Jr., but is what it is. They got the Bears taking Rome Odunze at 9. I could, you know, maybe the Bears are going to do that. I don't know what they're going to do. They're obviously taking Caleb Williams with that number 1 pick. But as for what they're going to do next, they might want to pick up an offensive lineman, defensive player. We'll see. And the last one he gave us was number 13th pick for the Raiders, Michael Penix Jr. Ooh, it'd be fun to see the former Washington QB end up in. Actually, it would not be fun. I'd feel bad for him. Raiders seem like a sinking ship right now. Come to the Vikings. We're fun. We're friendly. You know, we love people. We love people here at the Vikings. We also also lost like all our players. Makes me very sad. Speaking of the NFL draft, Brock Bowers, former Georgia tight end, is getting so much hype, and people are calling him the greatest tight end prospect of all time, and I can get behind the hype. He's super legit. It'll just be interesting to see what team he winds up in, and it's honestly, he could fall to the second round, he could go in the first round. He's one of those players that's just so unpredictable. Here's Maurice Jones-Drew's top 5 running backs for the 2024 draft. Number 1 is Trey Benson of Florida State. And when I think of teams that need a running back, I definitely think of the Carolina Panthers. They don't really have anyone. You know, when I kind of poke around the league, the Vikings have Aaron Jones. We could always use a backup. You know, I'd take a rookie behind Aaron Jones. Trying else to think. What team? The Raiders don't have Josh Jacobs anymore, so maybe they could use someone. I guess they got Zier White, but I don't know. Number 2 running back, according to Maurice Jones-Drew, is Will Shipley of Clemson, an absolute dog. Blake Corum of Michigan at 3. Now that, talk about a dog. That guy is crazy. I'm excited to see where Blake Corum goes. Number 4 from Southern Mississippi, Frank Gore Jr. I mean, come on. He's got to go to the 49ers. It's just Frank Gore. Wasn't Frank Gore legendary on the 49ers? Frank Gore got around to all the teams. Maybe he's on the Jets or Bills. Draft him anywhere. And then number 5, Jalen Wright from Tennessee. Happy to see where all those guys go. Honestly, I'm really happy for them. Happy for all the players. Other than that, not much, not very much, but here's actually some fun stuff, actually, to round out our NFL talk. Here are some NFL alumni who actually played in March Madness. Fun fact, Julius Peppers was on the North Carolina Tar Heels. Talk about an amazing athlete Julius Peppers was. Came to the NFL, great times with the, was he on the Bears and Packers? If I'm not mistaken, fun times. Jimmy Graham was actually on the Miami Hurricanes. Dude's an absolute menace. I mean, he's been on the Saints. Has he been on the Packers, the Bears? Jimmy Graham, legendary tight end. Tony Gonzalez, another tight end, was actually on the California Golden Bears. Huh. Tony Gonzalez, loved your time in Atlanta. Antonio Gates, former Charger, was on Kent State. Cool to see that. That's all we got for that. So, yeah, NFL, some fun stuff here, some fun stuff there, but as of right now, you know, I think we're more interested to see where all the QBs go. Caleb Williams, J.J. McCarthy, Jaden McDaniels, Drake May, Michael Penix Jr. Personally, I'd want Drake May. There's just something about those, like, UNC-type quarterbacks. You know, I just feel like they really come through great programs. I feel like they really have good conditioning out there in those types of schools. But I don't know. The NFL season looms in the distance, but I'm excited. Should we do a mock draft when it comes around? I don't know. That seems kind of too analytical for me, but that's all the NFL we got for today. And what else do we have? No more sports talk as we go back down memory lane. That's right. We are going to revisit some past WrestleManias. Of course, we revisited 1 through 10 on our past episode, our surprise episode where I made my bracket, which is not looking too sexy right now. A little worried about that, but you know what? I like going down. I used to be a huge WWE fan, and by the way, it's just fun to go back and look at stuff that you used to find so fun. So with that, let's go revisit WrestleManias 11 through 20. Checking in with WrestleMania 11. Like I said, we're just getting out of this Hulk Hogan type era. It was time for something new. And WrestleMania 9 went down at the Hartford Civic Center in Hartford, Connecticut. Fun fact, Connecticut's actually I think it is Hartford, Connecticut, is the, what is it, the headquarters of WWE. It's where like their headquarters is. Over 16,000 fans were in attendance for this, and they kind of took a different approach with this WrestleMania, and it was kind of like this new era of wrestlers. And I mean, first off, we had only 7 matches on the card, and you know, we're kicking it off, great tag team match between the Allied Powers called Lex Luger and British Bulldog, amazing wrestlers. Then we had Razor Ramon defeating Jeff Jarrett. Razor Ramon, legendary wrestler, that was for the Intercontinental Championship. You also had The Undertaker defeating King Kong Bundy. Undertaker's WrestleMania win streak slowly expanding from here. Owen Hart and Yokozuna defeated the Smoking Guns in a tag team match. And Bret Hart defeated Bob Backlund in an I Quit match. Then we got to what is basically the unofficial main event, probably the best match of the night, as Diesel, better known as Kevin Nash, your current champion, with Pamela Anderson in his corner, defeated Shawn Michaels, that's right, the legendary Shawn Michaels, to retain the WWF World Championship. This was a 20.5-minute match. Then we get to the main event where Lawrence Taylor, that's right, NFL defensive player, Lawrence Taylor defeated Bam Bam Bigelow in like 11 minutes in the main event. Very odd. It didn't really make sense. He had all of his NFL buddies with him too. Very odd. WrestleMania 11, probably headlined by The Undertaker being on here and that Diesel Shawn Michaels match. But Lawrence Taylor and Bam Bam Bigelow, nonetheless, still a fun fight. I mean, they had who else was on there? Ken Norton Jr., Chris Spielman, Ricky Jackson, Carl Banks, Reggie White. So many former NFL players at this WrestleMania. But that's just kind of, it speaks to how big WrestleMania is when you have so many of these celebrities, these other athletes going there and enjoying themselves. Moving on to WrestleMania 12, going down on Anaheim, California. Kind of had this Hollywood theme almost because it was in California. And first off, 18,853 people attended this. Better, bigger than last year, but not the biggest of all time. It was an 8-match card with 2 of them being, you know, they were starting to kind of do these things called prelims, like prelim fights or matches. I should better call it matches. And they kind of had 2 on here, all the relevant fighters, but kick off this, I guess then 6-match card. The British Bulldog, Owen Hart, and Vader defeated Ahmed Johnson, Jake the Snake Robertson, Yokozuna, all notable wrestlers of the early 90s, all fun, all legendary. Love seeing all these names, kind of revisiting that. You also had Roddy Piper defeating Goldust in a Hollywood backlot brawl match where they kind of, they redid O.J. Simpson running from the cops in his Bronco where they had Roddy Piper right away away from Goldust and the Bronco, which is a notable comical match. You also had Stone Cold Steve Austin, that's right, defeating Savio Vega. This was Stone Cold Steve Austin's WrestleMania debut, and he was slowly working into the Rattlesnake, you know, the legendary Steve Austin that we know today. The Ultimate Warrior squashed a young Triple H going under the name Hunter Hearst Helmsley in just under 2 minutes. You know, Triple H, he had to earn his stripes, and that does come with getting squashed at WrestleMania. The second to last match of the night was The Undertaker defeating Diesel in a very competitive match, nonetheless, very fun. And then the main event, which was a ballsy take, never has been done before, never will be done again. Shawn Michaels took on Bret Hart for the WWF Championship in a 60-minute Iron Man match where it went to overtime, and it wasn't until Shawn Michaels hit his signature leg kick, I don't even know what you call it, just a super kick, little bam right to the face in overtime. This was an hour in a minute and 56 seconds. This will forever go down as the longest WrestleMania match of all time. It is just insane. You know, it's notable it was the best part of this WrestleMania, but I mean, just an hour match, you know, the fans were kind of spent. It is some of the greatest technical wrestling you ever see. Shawn Michaels came in on a zip line, which is super cool, but yeah, we'll leave WrestleMania back in 1996, because, you know, it was pretty much just up from here. We get to WrestleMania 13 going down in Rosemont, Illinois. 18,197 people packed the Rosemont Horizon Arena in this 1997 production, and this is most known for Bret Hart versus Stone Cold Steve Austin, and it was a no disqualification submission match. And this is kind of where Bret Hart had a leg lock, if you will. I forgot what the actual term of it is called, but he had Stone Cold Steve Austin in this hold, and Stone Cold Steve Austin was bleeding. He passed out. It was known as like a referee stoppage, and it is just such a notable thing. And this was kind of when Stone Cold Steve Austin became the character he was. He was flipping off the camera, and this was new. This is not what wrestling used to be, and that was probably the best moment of this 8-match card. Main event was a no disqualification match for the WWF Championship, and The Undertaker defeated Psycho Sid in a 21-minute match. You also had Triple H finally getting a win over Goldust on this card. Owen Hart and the British Bulldog winning. I believe this was one of Owen Hart's final appearances in professional wrestling before he unfortunately passed away, which is very sad. You also had a young Rock under the name Rocky Maivia defeating the Sultan via pinfall to retain the Intercontinental Championship. So, fun stuff. Nonetheless, but just these WrestleManias aren't that notable, ain't that memorable. Like I said, there's obviously a lot of stuff that goes on afterwards. I mean, and all around it, I mean, the event paid out $837 in admission fees, which is pretty good, and it fell into a 0.77 buy rate from its normal audience, the people who were buying this, because it used to be that you had to buy a pay-per-view, which is also very very notable. And, you know, this match actually, the Bret Hart and Stone Cold Steve Austin match was given a 5-star rating, which is super rare from a Dave Meltzer, notable wrestling watcher, who pretty much rates every single match that takes place. Very, very fun job, I'm sure, that is, to watch every single wrestling match that goes down to all these major shows. Moving into WrestleMania 14, we were officially in a new era. We were in the Attitude Era of professional wrestling, going down March 29th, 1998 in Boston, Massachusetts at the Fleet Center, the 19,000 plus in attendance. This match was huge because guess what? The main event was Stone Cold Steve Austin versus Shawn Michaels with Mike Tyson as a special guest ring enforcer, and so many celebrities around this event, so much fun. You had the DX band playing them in. They also, they played the Star Spangled Banner 2 with their own little twist. So many celebrities, so much fun. And I actually have watched this entire WrestleMania start to finish, which is pretty fascinating. But yeah, it's most notable for Stone Cold Steve Austin and Shawn Michaels in their 20-minute match, which saw Mike Tyson knock out Shawn Michaels with a punch, and Stone Cold Steve Austin would hit the stunner on him to win. Legendary Stone Cold Steve Austin officially became the man, winning the WWF Championship. You also had The Undertaker defeating Kane in a very underrated match in the co-main event, if you will. And I love The Undertaker, love Kane. Very fun seeing them go to battle. You also had The Rock defeating Ken Shamrock, who actually fought in the UFC. The Rock beat him to retain the Intercontinental Championship. And you actually had Hunter Hearst Helmsley defeating Owen Hart for the European Championship. So I guess Owen Hart was still around at this time. Great to see. And you had Hawk and Animal two legendary wrestlers, rest in peace to them, winning a tag team battle royal to determine a number one contenders for the WWF Tag Team Championship, which they would then later go on to, they had a battle royale to become a number one contender at WrestleMania, and they didn't even get a fight at WrestleMania. Very odd. Very weird, but yes, The Rock stealing the show, and obviously Mike Tyson, Stone Cold Steve Austin, and Shawn Michaels stealing the show. I could watch that Stone Cold and Shawn Michaels match a numerous amount of times, and the audience was just so much more fun back then. 1999 marked the end of our 90s WrestleManias, and it was WrestleMania 15 going down in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania at the First Union Center. 19,500 people packed this to watch the Rock take on Stone Cold Steve Austin in a no disqualification match. And of course, there was a little controversy surrounding this card, and that kind of falls under the Undertaker and Big Boss Man's Hell in a Cell match, which actually saw the Undertaker hang the Big Boss Man. Like, I mean, I kid you not, he put a rope around his neck and he hung. He legit thought this man died in the center of the octagon. Like, he just got killed. It was very odd. No one really knew what to make of it. And it's one of the more forgettable matches in WrestleMania history. But Stone Cold Steve Austin and The Rock doing an almost 17-minute match. Amazing moments, stunners, rock bottoms, and the Stone Cold Steve Austin coming out on top. Absolutely love this. Absolutely love this. Love that main event. You also had Mankind taking on the Big Show in here. You had Butterbean. That's right, the boxer Butterbean knocking out Bart Gunn in a 35-second brawl for all match. So goofy. Owen Hart won the tag team championship on this card, so I guess Owen Hart was still around. I guess I do not recall when he passed away. Kane defeated Triple H in a disqualification match. Shane McMahon was on here defeating X-Pac, but the night belongs to Stone Cold Steve Austin and The Rock, probably the best moment on the card. I mean, just there's nothing too legendary here, but and I don't really think I've seen a majority of these matches. So WrestleMania 15, fun times, but not one of the greatest of all time. WrestleMania 2000, better known as WrestleMania 16, but it was labeled WrestleMania 2000 since it went down April 2nd, 2000 at Arrowhead Pond in Anaheim, California. 18,034 wrestling fans packed the arena, and this was a, you know what, good time in the ushering in the era of the 2000s. A lot of storylines here. You had Chris Jericho, Eddie Guerrero, the Hardy Boys, the Dudley Boys. A lot of fun matches on this WrestleMania, and we kick things off with a tag team match between Big Boss Man and Bull Buchanan defeating the Godfather and D'Lo Brown. Those are just, if there's any wrestling fans, those are just aesthetic names, if you will, but the best match on this card by far, a triangle ladder match for the WWF Tag Team Championship, which saw Edge and Christian defeat the Dudley Boys and the Hardy Boys in just a legendary ladder match. Jumping from the tops of ladders, going through ladders, jumping outside of the octagon. This is what made people love the ladder match so much. Such a legendary moment, so much fun. And I can never get enough of it. I can never get enough. But that was one of the greatest matches that I've ever seen. You also had Chris Benoit defeating Chris Jericho on here, along with Kurt Angle. But I mean, we kind of forget about Chris Benoit since he killed his wife and son and then killed himself. He's a very bad man. Kane won a tag team championship match with Rikishi against D-Generation X Surrendum. And then we get to our main event, which I've never seen this. I've never seen this main event. It's a fatal four-way elimination match for the WWF Championship. Lasted 38 minutes, and Triple H defeated The Rock, Mick Foley, and Big Show. And the whole theme around this was that every McMahon family member had someone in their corner. Triple H had his girlfriend, future wife, Stephanie McMahon, in her corner. The Rock was representing Mr. McMahon, Linda McMahon, Mr. McMahon's wife, had Mick Foley in her corner, and Shane McMahon had Big Show. Very random, very fun. Never really cared to watch this WrestleMania in full. All I say is that ladder match, legendary. I encourage you to go watch that. It is one of the matches that'll just make you go, wow, like these guys are legit. These guys really are who they say they are. WrestleMania 17, also known as WrestleMania X7, went down on April 1st, 2001 at the Resilient Astrodome in Houston, Texas. 67,925 fans came to see this. My goodness, absolutely jam-packed. And you already know, they had to do it again. Stone Cold Steve Austin versus The Rock in the main event. Absolutely crazy. A buy rate of 970,000 in America. 1,040,000 buy rate for a total, which, I mean, that's pay-per-view buys, might I add you. That's pay-per-view buys, so they made a lot of money off of this. Like I said, professional wrestling is a global endeavor, global endeavor. We are back to a long card here, 12 matches on the card. Kicking off, Chris Jericho defeating William Regal. Those are two legendary wrestlers. I'm sure you know about Chris Jericho. He actually is in the rock band Fozzy. Notable guy. They also had Kane defeating The Big Show, Eddie Guerrero defeating Test, Kurt Angle and Chris Benoit. It's a shame Chris Benoit was such a bad dude because he was such a great wrestler. Very unfortunate. Shane McMahon defeated Mr. McMahon in a street fight. Very fun. Edge and Christian defeated the Dudley Boys and the Hardy Boys in a TLC match. They're like, okay, how do we up last year? We're going to add ladders and chairs and tables to a match. And that just as fun as the first one. I mean, just talk about, like, you know, I'm comparing it to like how good the Godfather was, apparently. The Godfather 2 of matches, a TLC match for the Tag Team Championship. Edge and Christian coming out on top again. Then, second last match, the co-main event, if you will, The Undertaker defeated Triple H. And this would be their first match they'd ever had against each other. Little did we know that 10 years later, they would put on an even more legendary match. And we were starting to get a note here that The Undertaker had a streak, that it was something that, you know, people want to break, but it was still not really there. It was kind of like, okay, I guess The Undertaker hasn't lost at WrestleMania, but, you know, he just casually won this. Get to the main event, Stone Cold Steve Austin defeating The Rock in a no disqualification match, which went just over 28 minutes. And this is most notable as Stone Cold Steve Austin turned heel and sided with Mr. McMahon. Of course, there's a face, you're a good guy, heel, you're a bad guy, and it's just kind of forgettable because it just didn't really make sense. I mean, Stone Cold Steve Austin rivaled with Mr. McMahon. It's what made the Attitude Era so fun, so enjoyable. And it didn't really make sense him siding with him, especially we were now supposed to cheer for The Rock. You know, it's kind of odd, but we got it. It was good. Good match nonetheless, but I'll say the TLC match stole the show again. Back-to-back years, your best matches at WrestleMania was a three-way ladder match. So much fun. Very much enjoyed that. Next up, we got to WrestleMania X8, WrestleMania 18, going down in Toronto, Ontario, Canada at the Sky Dome. 68,237 Canadian wrestling fans across the globe headlined it. And this is a very odd WrestleMania because the main event shouldn't have been the main event. I mean, you even look at the promotional poster for this and it gives you Hulk Hogan versus The Rock. That's what the main event should have been. And I mean, you know, it was promoted as Icon versus Icon, and Triple H was starting to sink his teeth into making himself the main event when he shouldn't have been, and this was one of those cases. So obviously, card kicks off. You got Rob Van Dam defeating William Regal for the Intercontinental Championship. Rob Van Dam, amazing wrestler. Love him. You had Diamond Dallas Page defeating Christian. I mean, Diamond Dallas Page now does yoga and legit saves people's lives with his yoga. Amazing stuff. You had The Undertaker defeating Ric Flair. That's like Ric Flair drip, you know, the Migos? Yeah, Ric Flair, legendary wrestler, legendary, still kicking it, still alive. Crazy how that dude, he's drinking himself into oblivion, still is. But The Undertaker getting another win. You had Stone Cold Steve Austin defeating Scott Hall in just a singles match. So odd. And then we got to, not even the co-main event, the third to last match of the night, as The Rock took on Hollywood Hulk Hogan. And this is one of the greatest WrestleMania matches of all time. Not because it's actual great wrestling, but the audience was all about this. I mean, the moments they had, the finishers, just the entrances, the moments where they had friends coming out to help them. So fun. The Rock finally finishing Hulk Hogan. So great. And I believe this would be one of the final times we saw Hulk Hogan at WrestleMania. I mean, he might have made a couple appearances in the mid-2000s, but this was just incredible. The Rock and Hulk Hogan should have been the main event, and then instead, afterwards, they decided to give us a triple threat match for the WWF Women's Championship. No one cared about that. And then Triple H made him and Chris Jericho the main event. They gave a subpar performance in almost 20 minutes, and I think the fans were all kind of burnt out from The Rock versus Hulk Hogan. I mean, they were like, okay, The Rock versus Hulk Hogan was way better than this. We'll still give it our attention. But yeah, Rock versus Hulk Hogan, WrestleMania 18. Check it out. Still getting into our big attendances, we head to WrestleMania 19, which went down March 30th, 2003 in Seattle, Washington at Safeco Field. And this was an amazing WrestleMania. So many great matches here. The promotional poster had the notable, the Space Needle from Seattle on it. Incredible stuff there. And it was just kind of bold to hold it at a baseball stadium. And it worked. The entrance was super, super long. You had Ashante performing America the Beautiful. Beautiful to kick the night off, and this was just amazing. Just amazing, amazing matches. Where do we even begin? Because there were so many. It was a 10-match card, but kicking off our amazing matches on this card, you had the number 6 match of the night, Shawn Michaels defeating Chris Jericho, and what is just such a technical, amazing wrestling match. So many good kickouts. The crowd was loving it. Went over 22 minutes, and Shawn Michaels finally getting the edge over Chris Jericho. Loved it so much. Here for it. Shawn Michaels, Chris Jericho, two of the best professional wrestlers in the game. After that, you had Triple H defeating Booker T by pinfall to retain the World Heavyweight Championship. And this one is kind of frowned upon because Triple H was oddly making like racial comments in the buildup to this match. And it was just, looking back, it's kind of like, yeah, they should not have been writing those lines for these guys. So that's why we kind of forget about it. After that, you had Hulk Hogan, who I knew Hulk Hogan came back because he defeated Mr. McMahon in a pinfall match, in a street fight. I do remember this because Hulk Hogan dropped like a leg drop on a trash can while Mr. McMahon was like in it. It was so goofy, but I just love seeing Hulk Hogan and Mr. McMahon. Second to last fight of the night was the final, the trilogy between The Rock and Stone Cold Steve Austin. They gave an amazing performance, absolutely amazing. Just went right under 18 minutes at 17 minutes, 55 seconds. And The Rock getting the edge over Stone Cold Steve Austin, let everyone know, yeah, this was The Rock's time now. Stone Cold was kind of giving over the reins. He'd been at this for a decade. He was ready to pass it on to someone else, and The Rock able to usher that in. We got to the main event of WrestleMania 19, and Brock Lesnar defeated Kurt Angle for the WWE Championship in what was just a crazy, crazy match. And this is most notable as Brock Lesnar did basically a backflip off of the top turnbuckle and almost broke his neck. It's called a shooting star press, I think it was. And when he went to land, he just about broke his neck, concussed himself, was somehow able to finish up the last few minutes of the match, win the belt, celebrate and stuff. But man, we almost watched a live death on TV. Brock Lesnar now is kind of frowned upon because apparently he's a sicko, but nonetheless, Brock Lesnar, fun fighter in the UFC and in professional wrestling, even better. And Kurt Angle, just one of the guys you look to for advice for wrestling. We'll round out our little segment here with WrestleMania XX, WrestleMania 20, which went down March 14th, 2004 at Madison Square Garden, exact 20,000 in attendance, and it had 1.02 pay-per-view buys, bringing in that cheddar cheese. Madison Square Garden, one of the most famous venues on the planet. You know, it's very notable. I think the UFC now is kind of like this thing where they go there every year now in like the November area, and actually Kill Tony, one of my favorite YouTube comedy shows, is actually going there to do a full arena show, which I am absolutely pumped for. Checking in with WrestleMania 20, it was absolutely loaded with 12 matches on the whole card, and guess who is kicking us off? John Cena defeating The Big Show for the United States Championship, and John Cena picked up Big Show on his shoulders, gave him an add to adjustment. Yeah, John Cena was here to stay here, actually here to stay. He was here to come. You know, this was kind of his debut into the realm. Third match of the night, Christian defeating Chris Jericho. They had a fun little rivalry. I think it was centered around Trish Stratus. You know, she's a professional wrestler. They had like this angle, this storyline where they were both crazy over her. Very weird, but great technical wrestling there. You then had Evolution, the team of Randy Orton, Batista, and Ric Flair defeating the Rock and Zonk Connection, the Rock and Mick Foley, in a 3-on-2 handicap match. Some fun moments in there. The Rock and Mick Foley bringing out the nostalgia of the last 5 years. And it was kind of just like a young Randy Orton, young Batista, and Ric Flair still getting it done. You then had Brock Lesnar's, what was his final match in professional wrestling for 8 years, as he lost to Goldberg in a 13-minute match with Stone Cold Steve Austin as the special guest referee. And this was just a finisher fest, you know, spears, F5s, I mean, just kind of a mess. And Brock Lesnar kind of left on negative terms after losing. The same with Goldberg. They both didn't really end too well with the company, but they both came back years down the line. Moving on to our number 10 match of the night as Eddie Guerrero defeated Kurt Angle to retain the WWE Championship. This was an amazing moment. Eddie Guerrero had just beaten Brock Lesnar for the belt. He retained it here, and rest in peace to Eddie Guerrero, an amazing, amazing wrestler. And this was the highlight of his run here in the WWE, winning at WrestleMania. I wish he would have gotten the main event. Second last match of the night, The Undertaker, Fiend, Kane, and what would be their final match. This is kind of The Undertaker's return, and he actually had a very cool entrance where he kind of glided down the ramp or whatever, and it was a very cool moment, squashed him in just under 8 minutes, but nonetheless, legendary wrestling moment. And then, unfortunately, this is one of the most just let's forget about it main events of all time, as Chris Benoit defeated Triple H and Shawn Michaels in a 25-minute match to win the World Heavyweight Championship. And it sucks because this was some of the best, most technical, most clean wrestling, great moments, hardly any botches, like mess ups. And unfortunately, you know, this would be the last time Chris Benoit would ever be in a position to be big at WrestleMania because of just how terrible a dude it turned out that he actually was. It's kind of just like breaks your heart that, like, okay, yeah, this guy was not a great guy. He was not good, not at all. But, you know, thank goodness he didn't main event WrestleMania 21, which we'll talk about next episode. But yeah, we'll forget about that. Chris Benoit era, something the WWE tries to just kind of push under the rug. But going back, WrestleMania 11, not really the best. Same at 12, 13. WrestleMania 14, amazing WrestleMania. 15, 16, 17, you know, the TLC match is kind of what makes that. WrestleMania 18, The Rock and Hulk Hogan, the most amazing match on there. WrestleMania 19 had led by some great matches, but Brock Lesnar, Kurt Angle pretty much stole the show. WrestleMania 20, just so many nostalgic fights, but just the young fighters on there. John Cena, I guess Brock Lesnar was somewhat young at the time, Randy Orton. Fun times around, but our WrestleMania revisit will continue next week. Fun times with all of these wrestlers. Fun times indeed. But now, ladies and gentlemen, we get into our final segment of the episode as we are going to preview UFC Vegas 89 going down this Saturday at the UFC Apex. So we have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13 fights currently planned. I mean, stuff could change at the weigh-ins, but I doubt anything's going to change. We've got all the stats, all the knowledge you need to know before you make your predictions. I need to redeem myself. I went 5-7 last time out. I was upended by some of the other upsets that occurred, but we're back. We're ready to run through it. That's why y'all come here. It's the Surprise Jab Podcast for a reason. Jab represents the UFC, so let's get right on into it. Kicking off this average Apex card is a heavyweight matchup on the prelims, and it is Muhammad the Motor Usman taking on Mick Park, and that's right, Muhammad Usman, younger brother of Kamaru Usman, legendary welterweight champion. The Motor, that is a new nickname, I think, and I don't know how I feel about it, Muhammad, but nonetheless, let's go to the tail of the tape. Muhammad Usman, 11-2 professionally, Mick Park in 8-0, perfect. 6'2" to 6'4" gives Mick Park in 2 inches in height. Both men have a 79-inch reach, and both men stand in the orthodox stance. Muhammad Usman, this will be his fourth fight in the UFC. The 34-year-old was born in Nigeria, but now lives and trains in Texas. Actually trains at Fortis MMA. He actually went to the University of Arizona. Fun fact. He has a wrestling background and is currently on a 5-fight win streak. 3-0 in the UFC, last finish came August 6, 2022, when he knocked out Zach Pauga cold in round number 2, but in 2023 went 2-0, decision wins over Junior Tafa and Jake Collier, and the difference in both of those matchups was his grappling. So he's back today, looking to get a win, looking to move up the heavyweight rankings, which honestly it isn't too hard to do, but he is kind of falling into that average heavyweight, you know, typical stereotypicalness. So a matchup like this could really separate himself. That's no easy challenge as he takes on Mick Parkin, 28 years young, from England, of his 8-0 victories, 5 KOs and 1 submission. Those two decisions have actually been his two fights in the UFC. He got a round 1 submission on Dana White's Contender Series in 2022, and after debuting in July last year, he was able to outbox Jamal Pogues to a decision. He was able to outgrapple Kyle Machado to a decision win in November of 2023. Got just around 6.5 minutes of control time there. This is a very interesting matchup to me because I feel like it's 50-50. I honestly feel like, you know, both guys can strike, both guys can grapple. Mick Parkin's undefeated. Muhammad Usman, I mean, it's kind of tough to judge who's fought the tougher opponents. I will say that Zach Pauga was actually to become the Ultimate Fighter champion, so that shows how good Zach Pauga was at the time. Junior Tafa has knockout power, as we know of, but he last got beat from grappling, so, I mean, nothing too impressive here. And the Jake Collier win was very nice. He was able to kind of get around the fact he was getting outboxed at times, but nothing too much to look at from Muhammad Usman. And, you know, Kyle Machado did outstrike Mick Parkin. Mick Parkin did go 3 of 10 on takedowns. I think this is 50-50. We might see a finish here. We might see a finish, but I am going to choose Muhammad Usman. I am a fan of him, too. And I think that's another thing that you have to do at times is you kind of have to pick who you think is going to, whoever your favorite fighter is. And, you know, there's no real trends here, you know, for our Apex cards this year. Historically, the first fight, it's just been in fluctuation on whether it's a finish or a decision. So we're going to say Muhammad Usman, we're going to say by decision. I mean, both guys, 2-0 in the UFC in decisions, so we'll just go with that. But we'll leave that there. Nothing too exciting. Hopefully, whoever wins here, though, we'll have some good momentum, especially Muhammad Usman if he goes to 4-0 in the UFC. Next up, we got two debuting fighters in the men's flyweight division as Igor Severino takes on Andre Lima, nickname Mascote. Andre Mascote Lima. Ooh. Igor 8-0, Andre 7-0. That's right, someone's O has got to go. Both men are 5'7", and the only advantage we see is 2 inches in reach for Igor Severino, 69 inches to 67. Both fighters stand in the orthodox stance. Let's start off with Igor Severino, who is younger than me. He is 20 years old. He won on Season 7 of Dana White's Contender Series last September, where he got a Round 2 TKO of Renata Silva. Renata Silva actually rings a bell. Did he have a UFC fight? No, it must have just been a fight I covered on Dana White's Contender Series. But Igor, 20 years young, from Brazil, 4 KOs and 4 subs. Give him a 100% finish rate. That's right, this guy's a killer. And in his Dana White's Contender Series matchup, I mean, just utter domination. 2 knockdowns, 5-for-5 on takedowns, 83 total strikes to 38 against his opponent. Igor Severino is a killer. But he's got his hands filled with Andre Lima, 25 years young as well, from Brazil. Of his 7 victories, 5 knockouts. He also last fought on Dana White's Contender Series Season 7, and his matchup was last in August, where he beat Rickson Zanibab by unanimous decision. It was a competitive fight, back and forth. There's nothing really much to say. Like, oh, is there a weakness here? Is there a weakness there? But I am going to choose Igor Severino. 100% finish rate. Really makes me think, especially since this is an Apex card, we're going to see another decision to open up the night. But he's 20 years young. This should be lots of fun. Now, I will say inexperience could come into play for both these guys, so finish is very possible. But just for the sake of picking a winner, I really like Igor Severino's chances, especially he's got those 2 inches in reach. But we'll see. We'll see what happens. Getting into our first female fight of the night. I actually think we only have 2, this fight and then the main event. But it is a women's bantamweight matchup between Montserrat Rendon and Daria Zelenikova. Helzenivakova. Wow, she has quite the name. Daria Zelenikova, nicknamed the Iron Lady. The Iron Lady, wow. Montserrat Rendon, perfect 6-0. Daria is 8-1. 5'9 to 5'8 gives Daria 1 inch in height, and both women have a 68-inch reach. And for her stance, they don't even know what Daria's stance is. They don't even have Daria's stance listed because they don't even know. So we'll go to Montserrat Monster Rendon first. This will be her second fight in the UFC. The 35-year-old from Mexico is 6-0. All those fights are by decision. She won her debut back in September over Tamiris Vidal, thanks to grappling, 3 of 5 on takedowns for almost 5 minutes of control time. But she was kind of losing on the feet a bit. Tamiris Vidal, not the most talented opponent, might I add, but I mean, nonetheless, she's got a win in the UFC. Good stuff for her. As for Daria Iron Lady Helzenikova, whatever, 28 years old from Russia. I actually think she's from St. Petersburg, Russia. Of her 8 victories, 5 knockouts. Last win was on April 7th, 2023. She got TKO in round number 1. I didn't really catch what her win streak was. I think it might just be a one-fight win streak or previous loss. I think she got submitted, so that could play a factor. Don't really know what to think of this Montserrat Rendon decision machine. I'm just going to say that Daria wins. I like picking the Russian with ladies. Historically, it works out for me. She's gotten 5 KOs, but we're going to say another decision here just because we're just riding with decisions. I'm going to hope that none of these fights are decisions. But I am going to if I pick them all by decision, then maybe they'll all be finishes. Very, very fun. Alrighty. These prelims are kind of boring me, but this next one should not be boring. This is being looked at as potentially what could be one of the best debuts of the year. We head to the men's featherweight division as Jarno Arons takes on the debuting Steven the Ninja Huim. Here's a guy you want to keep your name on. Jarno Arons, 13-5-1. Steven Wynn, 9-1. 5'11 for both men, and both men have a 73-inch reach, but a switch stance for Steven Wynn, orthodox stance with that right arm for Jarno Arons. And I mean, Steven Wynn, I've seen him on Dana White's Contender Series. He is an absolute killer, right? Absolute killer. And by the way, he is one of the very few rare individuals who has been on 3 seasons of Dana White's Contender Series. 30-year-old from Kansas, trains at Fortis MMA, same gym as Muhammad Usman. Of his 9 victories, 4 KOs and 3 subs, and he currently rides a little 3-fight win streak. First came on season 3 of Dana White's Contender Series, where he was shockingly KO'd with a flying knee in round number 3 by Alan Cruz. Picked up some wins, came back on season 5 of Dana White's Contender Series in 2021, and picked up a win over Theo Rolongyang, but wasn't that impressive, you know? After that, went out, was able to get another win in 2022. Dana White said, you know what, you can come on for season 7 of Dana White's Contender Series. We'll give you one last shot, and he did not disappoint. Absolutely beat AJ Cunningham into a pulp. AJ Cunningham's face was so bloody, he got the round 2 TKO, and Steven Wynn is finally ready to make his UFC debut. The Ninja, for a reason. This guy's an absolute killer, and he can eat shots. AJ Cunningham was hitting him with some brutal stuff. Like I said, his only loss was that flying knee with 24 seconds left in the fight back in 2019. He's improved very much in the last 5 years. Jarno Arons, the 29-year-old, is from Holland. Probably one of the only UFC fighters I've ever known from Holland. Of his 13 victories, 3 KOs, and 5 subs. And most notably, of his 5 losses, 4 are by decision. So this guy's not getting finished off him. 0-2 in the UFC, lost the decision to William Gomez back in 2022. And last time he fought in August last year, he lost a decision to Sung Woo Choi. Now, he did land some knockdowns in that fight, but he also did get taken down in that fight, and he did get dropped himself. Jarno Arons started the fight off, you know, pretty even, you know, keeping him on the feet, was getting outboxed, shockingly landed a knockdown, but then got taken down, and then in round 3, kind of faded. So I think you're going to see Steven Wynn kind of come out with this ferocity, and he almost finished AJ Cunningham in round 1 on his Dana White's Contender Series fight. Love what Steven Wynn brings, and honestly, Jarno Arons hasn't given me anything in his first 2 UFC fights. Nothing to make me want to pick him. So round 1 knockout for Steven Wynn, and I'm really hoping so. We need some new blood. Featherweight's always looking for some new contenders. I'm hoping that Jarno Arons doesn't bring the fight as much as I think he might. But Steven Wynn, I'm riding with you. Best of luck in your matchup. Moving on to our 5th prelim of the night, we head to the men's bantamweight division as Miles Chapo Johns takes on Cody the Renegade Gibson. I was about to say Johnson, but it's Cody Gibson. Miles Johns is 13-2 with 1 no contest. Cody Gibson, 20-9. 5'10 to 5'7 gives Cody 3 inches in height, and he also has a notable 5 inches in reach, 71 to 66. Both men stand in the orthodox stance. And Cody Gibson was actually supposed to take on legendary UFC bantamweight Davy Grant. Davy Grant did unfortunately have to pull out, so Miles Johns decided to step in on short notice. Thank you so much, Miles. Miles Johns, 29 years old, born in Kansas, now trains in Texas, where he lives at Fortis MMA. Four KOs and two subs make up his 13 victories. Been in the UFC since 2019, actually won on season 3 of Dana White's Contender Series, earned himself a contract, then he won his UFC debut by split decision, suffered his first professional defeat to Mario Bautista with a flying knee. Mario Bautista, by the way, super talented fighter, is currently ranked number 13 in men's bantamweight, rides like a 6-fight win streak, but then got it going with back-to-back round 3 knockouts in 2020 and 2021, respectively, over Kevin Natividon and Anderson Dos Santos, earning himself a 50K performance bonus in both those fights. He then unfortunately got beat up by John Costanda in February of 2022, getting submitted in round number 3. Last win came in November of 2022, when he beat Vince Morales by unanimous decision. He did suffer an overturned decision against Dan Argueta back in September of last year, and I don't know if he won that or if Dan won. I'm sure I could flip through my notes and I would find it, but I honestly have no recollection about what went down in that fight. Just looking at the stats, I mean, it was pretty even. So Miles Johns doesn't officially have a win since November 2022, but he last fought in September of 2023. So happy to see him stepping in on short notice. He takes on Cody Gibson, 36 years old, born in Oklahoma, now lives in California. He's got a wrestling background, and of his 20 victories, 7 KOs, 4 submissions, and of his 9 losses, 4 of those were actually by submission. I found that notable. Cody Gibson, unfortunately, has not won a professional bout in a minute. He actually, this will be his second stint in the UFC after he won, or was runner-up on Dana White's, not Dana White's Contender Series, The Ultimate Fighter Season 31. Cody Gibson actually had his UFC debut in 2014 against Aljamain Sterling. Took him down 4 times in that fight, but ultimately lost. Then was able to get a knockout win over Johnny Bedford in 2014. In September of 2014, he got submitted in round 2. And his last fight in the UFC was in 2015 when he lost the decision to Douglas Silva de Andrade. But he came back, had a fight of the night against Brad Katona in at UFC 292. You know, this guy's a dog. He can bring it. And I really just don't see them bringing Cody Gibson back if they don't think he can win. And look, Miles Johns, it's kind of tough to tell how he'll perform. But I will say, against John Costanda, he got dropped. All right. And then he got submitted. And in that Dan Argueta fight, he got taken down. In the Mario Bautista fight, he got knocked out. So if he's fighting someone pretty good, you know, I'm actually going to pick Cody Gibson to win this matchup. Now, the only trouble that I come up with is the method of victory, because I want to say decision, but I also feel like Cody can get the finish here. So I am going to give him a round 3 submission. Round 3 submission for Cody Gibson. I think he gets it done. Maybe he could even get an earlier submission, but a submission win for Cody Gibson is what I'm leaning on. So best of luck to both men, but Cody Gibson, I lean with you, especially with that 5-inch reach advantage. He can even get a knockout. Moving up to the featherweight division, we have Ricardo Ramos taking on Julian Juicy J. Arosa. What a fun nickname. Ricardo Ramos is 16-5, Julian Arosa 28-12. 6'1" to 5'9" gives Julian Arosa a 4-inch height advantage. He also has 2 inches in reach, 74-72. Southpaw stance with that left hand for Julian, orthodox for Ricardo Ramos. Let's check in with Ricardo Ramos. The 28-year-old is from Brazil and trains at Team Alpha Male down there. Of his 16 victories, 4 knockouts, and 7 submissions. Of his 5 losses, though, 4 of those he has been finished in. Ricardo Ramos, been fighting in the UFC since 2017. Actually holds knockouts of Ayman Zahabi and Danny Chavez, both by spinning back elbow. Also holds wins over Kang Ho Kong, Bill Algeo. Fun stuff there. Of his 4 losses in the UFC, Saeed Nurmagomedov, Leroy Murphy, Zubara Tukagov, and most recently Charles Jourdain in September, this guy's legit. Like, he's a legit guy, and he also spices it up. There's some fights, especially the Charles Jourdain fight where he was takedown heavy, where he was getting outstruck. And the Danny Chavez fight back in June of 2022, he was all striking, getting a quick knockout. So it's kind of hard to see what you'll get from Ricardo Ramos, but I will say he's never lost 2 fights in a row. You know, that's something notable you could pick up on, but... And again, he did get submitted in 3 minutes last time out, just being too risky with his takedowns, and, you know, didn't work out for him, but Best of luck to Ricardo Ramos. His opponent, Julian Arosa. Very surprised that Julian Arosa isn't even cut. This is definitely a make or break for Julian Arosa. The 34-year-old trains at Extreme Couture, actually lives in Washington. And of his 28 victories, 11 KOs and 12 subs. Now, of his 12 losses, 7 of those are by KO, I might add. Julian Arosa, been in the UFC since 2015. Nothing really much. I'd say the biggest fight that he's had so far is that he beat Charles Jourdain by submission in 2021. You know, that's fun. But as of late, December 2022, got knocked out in 3 minutes by Alex Caceres. And in April of 2023, he got knocked out by Fernando Padilla in a minute 41. So Julian Arosa not really bringing in any positive momentum. Been almost a year since he last fought. And honestly, you know, round one finished, round one got finished. I think we're following a little pattern here. Yeah, give me Ricardo Ramos, round one knockout. It's just right there for me. Julian Arosa is not really coming in with any positive momentum at all. And might I add, Ricardo Ramos is not bad at all at defending takedowns. Ricardo Ramos actually has a 72% takedown defense. So if Julian Arosa tries to lean on the grappling, don't think it's going to work out for him. Julian Arosa does love to strike. He lands almost 6 strikes per minute compared to 3 for Ricardo Ramos. But mind you, Ricardo is much more accurate when it comes to the striking. So this should be a fun one. Hopefully it doesn't last too long, but we'll see what happens. With that, we get into what I believe is our 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. Yes, our final prelim of the night. A lightweight matchup between your Ultimate Fighter Season 31 winner, Kurt Holobow, as he takes on Trey the Samurai Ogden. I love Trey Ogden. Kurt Holobow, 21-7 with one no contest. Trey Ogden, 16-6 with one no contest. Trey versus Kurt. 5'11 for both men. 72 inches in reach to 70 inches. Gives Trey 2 inches there. And they both stand in the orthodox stance. Let's check in with Trey Ogden. Trey Ogden, 34 years old, born in Missouri, now lives in Kansas. Of his 16 victories, has 11 submissions. This will be his 5th fight in the UFC. In his UFC debut, he lost his, his 4th professional bout to Jordan Livet, or his 5th professional bout to Jordan Livet. He was going grapple heavy in that. They were leaning more on striking. Following that, he was able to beat Daniel Zaluber in September 2022. You know, the grappling and striking were on par there. Then lost to Ignacio Bahomanes in April of 2023. Just couldn't land the takedown. You know, Ignacio Bahomanes is great in the striking department. Didn't work out for him. But unfortunately, last time out in November, he was dominating Nicholas Motta, was on his way to a submission in round number 3 when a bad referee stoppage resulted in a no contest in a fight, which Trey Ogden should have won. The referee who, if it has it listed, Mike Beltran prematurely pulled Trey Ogden off of Nicholas Motta before Nicholas had submitted. And Nicholas Motta was complaining, and the commission decided that, you know, it would be ruled a no contest, which was just heartbreaking to see. Trey Ogden had worked so hard to get that submission and just did not pay off. So I do think Trey Ogden is very good. His grappling is very good. Submission abilities are good. I mean, of 16 wins, 11 submissions. I think he can get back on track here, but it won't be any easy going as he takes on the 37-year-old from Louisiana, Kurt Holobow. Of his 21 victories, 7 KOs and 10 subs, and he rides a 5-fight win streak into this. Similar to Cody Gibson, Kurt Holobow had originally had a stint in the UFC. This is actually his 3rd stint in the UFC. He had 2 fights in the UFC in 2013, losses to Pat Healy and Steven Silver by unanimous decision. Following that, he was able to get a win on the first episode of Dana's Contender Series, earning himself a contract, but it was actually ruled a no contest, his TKO of Matt Becerra. He was given a shot in July of 2018, where he had a fight of the night knockout loss to Ryony Barcelos. Following that, in November 2018, he would get armbarred by Shane Burgos in just over 2 minutes, and in May of 2019, he would lose a decision to Thiago Moises. Last time out, though, in August, he was able to get a submission of Austin Hubbard via a triangle choke in a fight where he kept getting taken down. Good win for Kurt Holobow, but I will say he is 37. He's getting a bit older. I don't know how he's going to do. I told myself the next time Trey Ogden fights, I will pick him. I do think Kurt is, like, too skilled to get submitted, so we'll give Trey Ogden a decision win here, but if Trey could get a submission, that would be very, very exciting. That would get me absolutely buzzing. Though I would, you'd be hearing me screaming from the rooftops. I'm obviously being dramatic, but Yes, those are our prelims. Just to recap all of our prelim predictions, so I don't have to go through them again. We go to Muhammad Usman defeating Mick Parkin by decision, Igor Severino defeating Andre Lima by decision, Daria Zarakonova, whatever, defeating Montserrat Rendon by decision, Stephen Wynn getting round one TKO of Jarno Ahrens, Cody Gibson getting round three submission of Miles Johns, a round one knockout for Ricardo Ramos over Julian Rosa, and a decision win for Trey Ogden over Kurt Holleboe. Very fun. All right, let's head to the main card and wrap up our podcast episodes. First off, we're in the men's featherweight division as Fernando El Valiente Padilla takes on Luis Corazon de Leon Pujela. Wow. Wow, my goodness. Quite the nicknames on these fellas. Fernando Padilla, 6'1", 15-5 professionally. Luis Pujela, 5'10", 8-1 professionally. 7-inch reach advantage for Fernando Padilla, 76 inches to 69 inches. Wow. My goodness, El Valiente's got the reach. And he's also got 3 inches in height on him. How about that? Let's check in with Luis Pujela first. He'll be making his UFC debut. He got a just under 4-minute knockout on Season 7 of Dana White's Contender Series back in August when he hit Robbie Ring with a knee in Round 1. Impressive stuff. It's earned him a debut fight against Fernando Padilla. And Luis, 29 years old, from Peru, of his 8 victories, 7 knockouts, and he currently rides a 5-fight win streak. I'm interested to see how he does in this debut, as it's no easy task taking on Fernando Padilla. Fernando Padilla, 27 years old, from Mexico, of his 15 victories, 5 KOs, and 8 subs, and of his 5 losses, he's never been finished. Won his UFC debut over Julian Arosa last April, getting himself just under a 2-minute knockout, but then did lose a decision to Kyle Nelson back in September at the UFC Noche, the Mexico-themed card. And this one's really tricky for me because, I mean, Luis Pujela, so talented, riding a little win streak, almost all knockouts, coming off Dana White's Contender Series. But that 7 inches in reach is what really sticks out to me. That's what really sticks out to me. Might I add you, Kyle Nelson has a 71-inch reach. So Padilla had 5 inches on him. He'll have 7 inches on Pujela. I'm really hoping that can make a difference. Pujela is not necessarily known as a grappler, so we are actually going to give this victory to Fernando Padilla, but I will say by decision, I don't know how Pujela's chin is, so I can't really judge him on that necessarily. So we'll say a decision win for Fernando Padilla El Valiente, but if Luis Pujela wins, I'll not be surprised. Some of these fights, it's just so 50-50. You never know what to do. Plus, Padilla's never been finished, so I'm not really going to pick a knockout artist against a guy who's never been finished. I feel like statistically, that would not work out. We stay in the featherweight division for our next bout as Billy Quarantillo takes on Yusuf the Moroccan Devil Zalal. Wow, that's a fun name. Billy Quarantillo, 18-5 professionally. Yusuf Zalal, 13-5-1. Both men are 5'10 and 2 inches in reach for Yusuf Zalal, 72-70 for Billy Quarantillo. Switch stance for Yusuf Zalal. Billy Quarantillo is orthodox with that right hand. Billy Quarantillo was supposed to take on Gabriel Miranda, but Gabriel Miranda had to pull out, so in steps Yusuf Zalal. Billy Quarantillo is 35 years old, born in New York, now lives in Florida. Of his 18 victories, 8 knockouts and 5 submissions. He's coming up an August win. Coming off an August win over Damon Jackson, where he won a unanimous decision over him August 5th last year. And Billy's been in the UFC since 2019, where he actually won on Season 3 of Dana White's Contender Series. Biggest win probably over Alexander Hernandez, got a round 2 TKO performance tonight over him in December of 2022. But last year in April, he did get knocked out with a knee by Edson Barbosa in that Damon Jackson fight in August. He did get taken down 3 times. So Billy does have some holes in his game plan, but he actually does have a fight of the night win over Gabriel Benitez, got a round 3 TKO of him. He's talented, he's good, and I like what Billy Quarantillo brings to the table. The man stepping down on short notice is Yusuf Zalal, riding a little 3-fight win streak. The 27-year-old, born in Morocco, now lives in Denver and trains at Factory X Muay Thai. Of his 13 victories, 4 KOs and 6 subs, and of his 5 losses, he's never been finished. Yusuf had originally had a stint in the UFC from 2020 to 2022, kicked off with a 3-fight win streak before dropping 3 straight fights, losing decisions to Ito Pura, Sung Woo Choi, and Sean Woodson. His last time he was in the UFC was August of 2022, where he drew against Damon Blackshear. But since leaving the UFC, gone on a little 3-fight win streak, some people have taken a notice to him. And he's back, ready to bring the heat. Like my last fight, where I was saying, you know, here's a guy who's never been finished, fighting a knockout artist. There's just something about Billy Quarantillo that really gets me going. Yusuf Zalal's taking this on short notice. I understand he's fought some tough guys, but Billy Quarantillo is a tough guy. So we're giving Billy Quarantillo the nod here. And on Verdict MMA, I think they give a juicy amount of XP if you get a knockout, but we're going to say a decision for Billy Quarantillo. I'm going to play it safe with this decision. I feel like there's going to be a lot of decisions on this card. Like I said, if I'm predicting decisions, I'm hoping for finishes. So we're going to pick Billy Quarantillo. I just think he's been fighting more experienced talent in the UFC. And Yusuf Zalal, he's kind of been out of the octagon for 2 years, fighting some of the lesser known names. But we'll see what he offers. We'll see what he brings. Best of luck to both men. Moving into our next fight, we head to the men's bantamweight division as Peyton Talbot takes on Cameron MSP Saman. Peyton Talbot is 7-0, undefeated. Cameron Saman 9-1. 5'10 to 5'8 gives Peyton 2 inches in height and 3 inches in reach, 70 to 67. A switch stance for Peyton Talbot, southpaw for Cameron Saman. We'll start it off with Peyton Talbot. This will be his second UFC fight in the UFC. 25 years young, from Nevada, of his 7 victories, 5 KOs, and 1 submission. Actually won on season 7 of Dana White's Contender Series. I feel like that's where every fighter on this card that's debuting is from, season 7 of Dana White's Contender Series. Got unanimous decision win over Reyes Cortez Jr. And then in November, won his UFC debut over Nick Aguirre, getting a round 3 rear naked choke. Now, Nick Aguirre was just so takedown heavy and just wore himself out, and Peyton stayed through it, was able to grind out the wrestling. He got a submission victory in round number 3. Fun to see that. Peyton, super talented, has a weird like circle, like straight blacked out circle in the center of his back. It's a very odd tattoo, really, really is fascinating to me, but I'll be excited to see Peyton fight. Cameron Saman, also another guy I've been itching to see get back in the octagon. The 23-year-old is from South Africa and has a kickboxing background. Of his 9 victories, 6 knockouts, and 1 submission. Cameron had previously been undefeated, a perfect 3-0 in the UFC with finishes of Stephen Koslow and Terrence Mitchell by TKO, for he lost the unanimous decision to Christian Rodriguez in October of 2023. Got brutally outgrappled in that fight, taken down 3 of 6 times, just looked out of place. And by the way, Christian Rodriguez, we talked about him last week with Isaac Dolgarian, the ultimate undefeated fighter taker. You know, obviously he's not undefeated, but he's been beating all these undefeated guys. But, you know, Cameron, I know he's talented, so Peyton, as much as he is a stand-up guy, I do think he's going to take this to the ground, and I love picking stuff that's happened in past fights. Who doesn't love to do that? Give me Peyton Talbot round 3 submission. Also, Verdict MMA has given out quite the hefty XP boost, and I'm trying to get my black belt in that app, so we'll see how we do there. But Peyton Talbot, I like the kid. I wish him nothing but the best, and we're going to say a round 3 sub for the kid. Let's get it, Peyton Talbot. Plus, Cameron Saman, you know, he just lost. Probably a tough loss to take in. Third to last fight of the evening, we head up to the men's middleweight division as Edmund the Golden Boy Shahbazyan's last chance in the UFC as he takes on AJ Dobson. Edmund was supposed to take on Dusko Todorovic, who was in a similar situation on a losing streak, but AJ Dobson will step on short notice in place. Edmund is 12-4 professionally. AJ Dobson 7-2 with 1 no contest. 6'2 to 6'1 gives Edmund 1 inch in height, and AJ has 1 inch in reach, 76-75. Both men stand in the orthodox stance. Let's check in with Edmund Shahbazyan, man. Oh, man, I used to be an Edmund Shahbazyan fan. I really did. The 26-year-old from Nevada trains at Extreme Couture. 10 KOs and 1 sub make up his 12 victories. But son of a gun, he's just been on a terrible streak. 1-4 his last 5 fights. Oh, man, hasn't won since December 2022. It's been rough. It's been rough. After starting out his career undefeated 11-0, including finishes of Charles Byrd, Jack Marshman, and a knockout of Brad Tavares in round 1, he unfortunately loses his first professional bout to Derek Brunson in August of 2020. Following that, he would lose a decision to Jack Hermanson, get TKO'd by Nazanin Imavov in 2021. He would pick up that win over Dulce Luciambula in a performance of the night knockout, but last time out, May 2023, got brutally outgrappled by Anthony Hernandez and unfortunately lost. But this is a step down in competition. You have to think. Emin Shahbazyan's four career losses, one's to Derek Brunson, former top five fighter, former almost middleweight challenger. His other losses to the number 12, the number 9, and the number 8 middleweights currently on the roster. Edmund has only been fighting the most top-tier contenders, so I do think Edmund can get back into it, but it won't be easy as he takes on AJ Dobson, the 32-year-old from Ohio. Of his 7 victories, 3 submissions, 2 KOs, and he's never been finished. That's right. He is 1-2 in the UFC. Decision losses to Jacob Malkoon and Armin Petrosian were the exact opposite happened in both the fights. Against Jacob Malkoon, he was outgrappled. Against Armin Petrosian, he was outstruck. He did pick up a win over Tafan Inchukwi back in August of 2023. Got that done through his grappling and his striking, but for this one, I'm riding with Edmin Shahbazyan. I think Edmin has to bring the fight to. I think he has to bring the fight to AJ Dobson, and he can get this done. AJ's a bit experienced compared to Edmin, who's even younger than him, 6 years younger. And I just, when we look at the competition they've been fighting, AJ's been fighting nowhere near who Edmin Shahbazyan's been fighting. I told myself I wouldn't pick Edmund after his last fight, but I got it. This is the last stand for Edmund Shahbazyan. Give me a round one TKO. Come on, Edmund. I'm rooting for you. We'll see how he does, but man, really hoping he gets it done. I really hope he does, because if not, I'll be sad. All right, let's get into our co-main event of the evening, and we head to the men's heavyweight division as Carl Williams takes on Justin Badman Tafa. Carl Williams, 9-1 professionally. Justin Tafa, 7-3 with one no contest. 6'3 to 6 foot gives Carl's 3 inches in height. And he also has 5 inches in reach, 74 to 79. Orthodox stands for Carl, southpaw for Justin Tafa. Carl Williams, the 34-year-old from Georgia, trains at American Top Team. Of his 9 victories, 3 KOs. Just 3 KOs. That's all he is. He rides a 6-fight win streak. His one loss was by submission back in, I think, like 2019 or something. Been a minute. Carl Williams was supposed to fight Junior Tafa, but as we all know, Junior Tafa and Justin Tafa kind of did a switcheroo at UFC 298. So Justin Tafa was supposed to take on Marco Sergio de Lima. It did not end up working out like that. Instead, he steps in to take on the man his younger brother was supposed to fight in Carl Williams. Carl Williams won on season 6 of Dana White's Contender Series. Using his grappling, he was able to get a contract. Last year, 2-0, wins in March and May over Lucas Brzezik and Chase Sherman. You know, used his grappling in both those fights and his striking to get it done. Carl, been at it for a while, been happy for you, but your time is a-coming as he takes on the bad man, Justin Tafa. The 30-year-old from Australia has 7 KOs of his 7 victories. And you may be asking, Zach, when did all these KOs take place? Yeah, they're all round 1 KOs. Absolutely love them. Absolutely love Justin Tafa. He's currently on a 4-fight unbeaten streak. Debuting in 2019, he was knocked out by Jorgen De Castro, but he followed that up with a 2-minute knockout of Juan Adams in 2020. He would then lose a split decision to Carlos Felipe, following that a fight of the night lost by unanimous decision to Jared Vandera, but since December 2021, he's been on fire under a 2-minute knockout of Harry Hunsucker. Almost a 1-minute knockout of Parker Porter last year in February, had a no contest against Austin Lane in June, but back in September, was able to avenge that with a 1:22 knockout win against Austin Lane, earning himself a 50K performance bonus. This man is essentially the next Tai Tuivasa, fighting guys like Carl Williams. It won't be easy for Justin, but this fight is either going to go two ways for you. Let me tell you, either Justin Tafa gets a round one knockout or Carl Williams gets a decision win. And as for me, I'm riding with the first option, Justin Tafa round one knockout. I mean, come on, it is right there. It is so fun. I love Justin Tafa. I'm sorry, Carl, but you know, you're Carl with a K. No excitement behind you. The bad man, Justin Tafa, he's where the excitement's at. Give me Justin Tafa round one knockout. I'm here for it. I love it. We're going to need some excitement before we get to our main event. Do we even have to talk about it? Do we even have to talk about it? All right, we do. To end out this video, let's look at our main event for UFC Vegas 89. Headlined by your number 8 ranked women's flyweight, Amanda Ribas and Rose Namajunas. Yeah, That's all we got. Manda Hebus, and Rose, Thug Rose, Nami Yunus. Thug Rose, that's her nickname, yeah. Manda Hebus, 12-4 professionally. Rose Nami Yunus, 12-6. 5'5" to 5'3" gives Rose 2 inches in height. 1 inch in reach for Manda Hebus, 66-65. Both women stay in the orthodox stance. Let me just tell you, my excitement level has died because this is a brutal main event. There's only one ranked fighter on this card. That's insane. I don't think I've ever seen it. There's only one ranked fighter on a card. That's like the first UFC event ever. Manda Hebus, 30 years young from Brazil. 3 KOs and 4 subs make up her 12 victories. And of her 4 losses, 3 are actually by TKO, which I find very fascinating. Manda Hebus has been in the UFC since 2019. When she started, she was on a 4-5 win streak to kick off her career, but lost by knockout to Marina Rodriguez in January of 2021. Following that, she would actually lose a fight of the night to Caitlin Serminara in May of 2022, following that up with a win over Viviana Rujo in March of 2023 last year. After that, she would lose in June to Macy Barber, getting brutally and bloodily TKO'd in round 2. Oh my gosh, it was a bloodfest. But last time out in November, was able to get a performance of the night, round 3 TKO over Luiana Pinheiro. That was a competitive fight. That was actually fun, but you know what? We'll see how she performs against Thug Rose Namajunas. The 31-year-old, born in Wisconsin, now lives in Colorado. Of her 12 victories, 2 knockouts, 5 subs. Really hoping we see a knockout in this one. I'm really hoping we do. Thug Rose Namajunas, former women's strawweight champion, 2-time women's strawweight champion, might I add. Of course, lost to Carla Esparza on The Ultimate Fighter back in 2014. Followed that up with wins over Angela Hill, Paige VanZant, Tisha Torres. Lost a close split decision fight of the night to Caroline Kowalski back in 2016. After submitting Michelle Warrison Gomez in round 2, she's able to get a title shot and shockingly knocked out Joanna Jędrzejczyk in 3 minutes. Following that, she would defend her belt against Joanna. Then in May of 2019, get shockingly slam KO'd to lose the belt against Jessica Andrade. That was a fun fight. After that, she would have a fight of the night win over Jessica Andrade in 2020. Following that, she would beat Zhang Wei Li to win the belt at UFC 261, knocking her out with a head kick in just over a minute. After that, she would have a competitive fight in November 2021 against Zhang Wei Li. But since then, had one of the worst fights in UFC history, where she lost the belt to Carla Esparza. And her last time out, in September 2023, she lost a unanimous decision to Manon Fiora. Did outstrike her, but it's clearly just not the power puncher. Rose, you know, up in weight, fighting at women's flyweight. Don't know how it's really treated her so far. 2-fight losing streak. It's just, she used to be so fun, so exciting. And since the Zhang Wei Li fight, she just kind of has lost that edge. She's kind of lost it. And as much as Manda Hebus is coming off a KO, I'm not going to forget that, you know, last year in June, she got brutally TKO'd. And after getting a good TKO in November, you know, I don't know if they really correlate. But we're picking Rose Namajunas. Nonetheless, we're riding with Rose Namajunas. She's the star, former champion. If she loses to Manda Hebus, that might be it. Might need to send her off to the PFL or Bellator. But as you know, of her 4 losses, Manda Hebus has been TKO'd 3 times, and I've seen it twice in the UFC. It's tough to say. Both women can grapple. Both women can strike. But we are going to say decision for Rose Namajunas. That's the safe bet, safe payoff. So there we are. Rose Namajunas by decision over Manda Hebus. And if Rose Namajunas wins, she'll be ranked number 8 at women's flyweight. How fun is that? So yeah, let's recap. Our main card predictions. We got Fernando Padilla over Luis Pajelo by decision. Billy Quarantillo over Yusuf Zalal by decision. Peyton Talbot over Cameron Saman by round 3 submission. Edmund Shabazian over AJ Dobson by round 1 TKO. Justin Tuff over Carl Williams by round 1 KO. And Rose Namajunas over Manda Hebus by unanimous decision. That brings an end to our UFC Vegas 89 predictions. Let me just tell you, I'm not too excited for this card, but nonetheless, it's UFC. I enjoy it. I watch it. It gives me a platform to talk about it, so that's what we will do. We'll be back Monday with an absolutely star-studded, oh my gosh, going to be such a long episode. We'll be recapping this. We'll be going over WrestleMania, and we'll be freaking, I might even be talking about The Bachelor, who knows. I'm going to also have to talk about all of the games that go down in March Madness, but that'll be fun. I enjoy it. Ladies and gentlemen, that's all we got for today. Fun one today, talking about sports, talking about wrestling, talking about UFC. That's what we love to do. That's what we do here. Everyone, have an amazing weekend. Have an amazing week. Whenever you listen to this, just know you matter. You're amazing, and you will accomplish great things. And by the way, I'll catch you out next time on the Surprise Jab Podcast.